As we were just discussing before we came down here, there are something like two dozen, maybe, election law lawyers in Washington whose full-time practice is in fact election law. These are the people who run the political world, and he's among them. So I want to save most of our time to hear from him, but here's what I do want to do now, spend just a couple of minutes, well, first of all, saying thanks to Rachel and the Journal for organizing the event and everyone for coming. I also want to spend a couple of minutes just explaining very briefly what exactly a super PAC is and why people worry about them, or at least some people do. So some of you may already know this if you've taken my class, but for others, I suspect it's still something of a black box. So let me just give you this little skiff of background to kind of set the stage, and then Joe will talk, and if there's time at the end, maybe I'll get back up and try to fulfill my theory part of the day. So in brief, a super PAC is an independent expenditure-only committee, which doesn't clear things up. So let me take half a step back. In election law, in campaign finance law, we draw a distinction between what are called contributions on the one hand and what are called expenditures on the other. So I can illustrate with an example. A contribution works like this. You give money directly to a candidate for office or to the campaign. So suppose in November you jumped on the website of Barack Obama before the election and you punched in your credit card number and gave him $100. That's a contribution. Contributions are capped under federal law, and they're capped on the theory that they can be corruptive. If I give you too much money, you may feel indebted to me and do me some favors later that the law prohibits you from doing. So contributions are capped. All right, now let's flip to the other side of the coin and talk about expenditures for just a minute. So suppose that instead of going on Barack Obama's website, you just opened up your wallet and spent $100 taking out ads in the Law Weekly that said, "Vote Barack Obama," or "Vote Mitt Romney," or whatever else. Well, that's an expenditure. You're not contributing it directly to Obama's campaign. You're not coordinating with the campaign. They didn't ask you to run the ad or tell you what to put in it. You just independently spent your own money. Okay, so those are expenditures, or independent political expenditures. Okay, unlike contributions, which are capped at the federal level, at least for now, independent political expenditures are not. You can engage in unlimited sums of independent political spending. How can that be, you say? How can it be that contributions are corruptive and therefore capped, but independent expenditures are not? Well, this is the central, I think, controversial point in the Supreme Court Citizens United decision. That's where the court said, among other things, independent expenditures don't cause corruption. There are a number of ways to interpret that phrase, but in practice, what it means is you can't cap these things. They don't raise a sufficient risk of corruption that it's okay for the federal government to cap them. So I can only contribute so much to Obama or Romney, but independently, I can spend everything I've got. All right, so now we can talk for a minute about super PACs. They are independent expenditure-only committees. They're just organizations who engage in these independent expenditures. And there's no cap on the amount of money they can spend. So if they have $100,000 available to them, they can spend it. If they have, this is theoretically possible, $1 billion available, they can spend all that too. And nobody can stop them. One last point to mention. Because these independent expenditures by super PACs have been held not to cause corruption, independent expenditures don't raise this problem. And you can therefore, super PACs can engage in as much of them as they want to, people and organizations can give as much to super PACs as they want to. Right? If the super PAC spending isn't corruptive, then giving to a super PAC can't be corruptive. So it's not just that they can spend unlimited sums, they can raise unlimited sums. If only I had the resources, I could write a check today for $100 million to any super PAC I like. So now you can maybe, in case it wasn't clear before, you get some sense of what super PACs do. They're not giving money to politicians. They're spending independently. Now, whether there's a real line between the two or not, maybe Joe is going to help us figure out. The last point I want to make is just that you can see why people get nervous about them. Anytime there's this much money sloshing around in politics, and this is a lot of money, regardless of what some Supreme Court justices rightly or wrongly think where the line is or should be between corruption or not and what you can and can't regulate, people get nervous. It's the concentration of wealth, and that's what these super PACs have. I am going to stop now and let the star of the show talk, Joe Bergenstock.
Thanks very much, Mike. And thanks, Rachel, and obviously the group. I really appreciate the chance to come down. And as I said to Mike earlier, it's a chance not to go to the office for a day. So, you know, if nothing else, I don't say no to that. and also, anytime anybody wants to suggest that I and 23 of my colleagues get to run politics, I'm always glad to hear that. That's going to show up on my bio, I think, soon on my firm's webpage. But I really do appreciate the chance to talk about super PACs, and I thought the theory and practice concept was kind of a perfect way to do this, because super PACs kind of has a concept as, you know, like my in-laws or, you know, people's neighbors and so forth. Everybody's heard of this, and yet I think more often than not, no two people have kind of heard the same thing. There's a super PAC story. There's kind of like this thing that is super PAC that lives in the popular understanding of what happened last year, how politics works. And then there's like the actual technical definition that Mike just laid out, that, you know, this really, there's a actual beast called a super PAC, but then there's a label that gets used to talk about basically anything that makes independent expenditures. I'm going to get into a couple of stories of, you know, fact patterns, I suppose, that illustrate some of that contribution and expenditure distinction that Mike talked about. But I think the starting point for this is to bear in mind that there are actually a lot of different kinds of groups that now make independent expenditures, and even were making independent expenditures before Citizens United. There's, again, I think, an understanding sometimes of that case as this massive sea change in the law, when I don't really think that's a fair way to consider it. It was a change in the law, but a kind of an incremental one. And maybe over the course of the next 10, 15 minutes, I might get a chance to kind of explain why I see it that way and maybe think about where things are going to go, you know, from here. But no event that involves super PACs should ever really get going without talking about Stephen Colbert. As you probably know, Trevor Potter is the head of my practice group and is obviously an active practitioner in the field. And I thought I'd quickly start with an explanation of how Trevor came to be on the Colbert Report. Trevor's a great guy and an unbelievably good lawyer, not necessarily the person who's most attuned to popular culture. There was actually a McCain ad in 2008, which I found out about afterwards. Obviously, it had nothing to do with the McCain campaign, but there was that ad that they ran about Obama as a celebrity in Europe, you know, traveling Europe and kind of being, you know, faded by these fawning crowds. And at some point, they worked in visuals of Paris Hilton and Britney Spears. And apparently, when Trevor and our associate Matt Sanderson were vetting the ad, everybody, you know, all right, that looks fine. I think that's okay. And Trevor said, "Well, we're going to need releases, though, right, from those two young blonde ladies? I mean, they need to be. We need their authority to use their likeness." And it had to be pointed out to him that actually, they are fairly well-known celebrities themselves. They're newsworthy. We're really not going to have an issue with the use of their images. So, with that in mind, imagine the phone call that Trevor gets from a producer for the Colbert Report. "We're thinking about starting to work with super PACs a little bit. We think we might want to do a segment. We're going to put you on camera and do a quick interview with you." Well, Trevor takes that story to myself and to Matt to say, "What do you think? Is this a good idea?" And of course, Matt and I look at each other and think, all right, there's two ways this could go. You could be the serious person that they interview and take seriously and use as an actual subject matter expert, or you could be the guy with the big nose and the long shoes and the, you know, bozo hat, and they could really give you the full chump ride. So we were happy enough to be able to go back and forth with the producers to say, look, if you want Trevor to be your serious interview subject, we are of course thrilled. You know, he would be thrilled. He is thrilled to engage in that. But we were able to help Trevor push through that a little bit to make sure that they only had the serious version in mind and not the buffoon guest version in mind. But the serious point about that is, at the time that began, I don't think anybody had any idea how salient that was going to get. They are an incredibly creative group of people. Needless to say, they are unbelievably sharp and fast. Among all of the work that I've done in 20 years, that Trevor's done over 30 years, I thought it was one of the most challenging projects to work on, in the sense of, we're going to start shooting in 15 minutes. Here's the idea. And, you know, these two jaded old Washington hands kind of look at each other like, that is absolutely the first time I've ever thought about that prospect in any way, shape, or form. And so you have this race to try to get it all figured out. But I mean, in terms of illustrating what a super PAC is and the dangers that it poses, I don't think any Everybody, academic, practitioner, or otherwise, has had as much success shining a light on what those issues entail as Stephen Colbert did over the course of the last year. You might, if you were a fan of the show, you'll recall a couple of instances where he was going to hand the pack off to Jon Stewart because he was going to run for the president of South Carolina, which we were, of course, very careful to make sure he was always consistent in saying president of South Carolina, because really there were a lot of other people following that effort who were probably not thrilled that he was making light of what people consider to be very serious rules and would have loved to get the chance to actually catch him out on an actual legal violation. So the issues of coordination, for example, as they highlighted back and forth, I can't tell you to run that ad. I can't ask you to run that ad. And there was one I recall where John was talking about two different cities. Should we put it up in Charleston or should we put it up in, Columbia, South Carolina? And Colbert kept smiling or frowning depending on which, where the ad was going to go. As a matter of law, that was probably coordination. If they were actually doing that, if Colbert were actually a candidate and the resulting ads would actually be expenditures advocating for Colbert as president, that would really have been visual proof of coordination. But it illustrates, I think, sometimes also how technical those rules can get. If he hadn't been smiling or frowning, but instead he had been asking his own consultants, would it make more sense to do this in Columbia or in Charleston, what those consultants would have done is go to the CMAG database or a lot of other publicly available sources of information, which let you know where the candidate is running their ads. So it's not a big secret. It's not like nobody can tell what a particular person's strategy is. I just need to go look up, well, where are your ads running? Are you full? Is there time to be had there? If so, I'll throw a few gross rating points in there too. If you're not advertising in Montana, because maybe Montana's written off and you don't need to worry about those electoral votes, well, I'll skip that one. So the idea of coordination is something that flows from kind of like the smile versus the frown or the winks and the nods and so forth. That is actually what gets regulated. But it's not a mode of regulation that actually gets you very far. There's not much that forecloses beyond very direct, I really appreciate ads about this topic, for example, but I wouldn't want to see ads run about this other topic. The other thing I think to bear in mind on that point as well, if you look at how super PACs came to pass, how did we get to the point where we have this independent expenditure vehicle now? It's really a series of cases that never presented the actual facts that super PACs present now. Nobody litigated super PACs as you saw them in 2012. This grows out of Buckley, which made the contribution expenditure distinction in the first place. MCFL would be in there, nonprofit organization that was undertaking some relatively minor independent expenditures, all with money provided by individuals, so no business corporations involved in funding the MCFL group. There were rules at the time, and at least there could be rules today, that would require disclosure of every dollar spent on that kind of independent expenditure. But you didn't really see them really explode until you saw a fact pattern that allowed them, for one, not to be disclosed. Well, that was never litigated. Look again at even Citizens United. That wasn't a case that presented a challenge to the disclosure rules, at least not initially. And even once the decision actually came down, you had 8 votes saying, we completely support disclosure. Of course it's permissible to require disclosure of these sorts of information. The Kennedy opinion, actually, the CU opinion, is really kind of illustrative on this. He's got several sections in there where he really lauds the idea of how the internet is going to make this more palatable. The risks posed by enormous independent expenditures will be lesser in his eye because the internet will make that sort of disclosures instantly available. Everybody can judge for themselves, shareholders, customers, what have you. Everybody can make their own conclusions about the funding of the ad. Well, Kennedy himself was in a position to realize that's not the case. If a for-profit corporation can run its own ad and there's nothing to disclose. It'll just say Exxon Corporation paid for this ad. Well, if Exxon gives to, the Colbert version was Super PAC SHH, you might recall. He set up his shell. It was going to be anonymous shell corporation, I think, for a while. And I think it was on the episode at some point. They decided to change the name to Super PAC, Colbert Super PAC SHH.
And it's not technically a super PAC.
Exactly.
My favorite.
Absolutely right. But that's the point. The idea was, well, yeah, viewers can make their own conclusions. They'll judge for themselves whether this is fair or unfair. Not only viewers, but again, customers, shareholders, they'll make their judgments. If I own Exxon or, you know, 1/1,000,000th of a percent of Exxon, if I'm not happy with the way that they're spending their money politically, maybe I'll sell my shares. Well, that presumes that you know. But if the money goes into the SHH first, and from the SHH it goes over to the super PAC, or as again, as we saw increasingly over the course of last year, they leave the technical super PAC out of the equation. Don't give the money to anything that is a PAC. It never reaches a political committee at all. If the dollars are spent directly by the 501c4, then that's the only disclosure you get. You get the disclosure that says paid for by Colbert Super PAC SHH, period. When they file, it's called a Form 9, when they file this document with the FEC, they show every vendor that they paid to create the ad, and they identify by name any donor that gave funds in furtherance of the reported communication. So if a corporation or an individual gives to SHH to say, I want to run that ad right there, you showed me the storyboards, we worked on the script, I know the buy schedule, that's the one I want to pay for, that donor must be disclosed. Under the current regulation, if you fall short of that, as you almost always do, but it's rare that a donor has that level of information provided over the course of discussing a potential ad flight. So instead of saying, I want to fund that ad right there, the donor says, here's $1,000,000. Please use it as you see fit. That donor doesn't get disclosed. So again, Justice Kennedy writes an opinion saying, this is all going to be fine. Customers and shareholders and voters can understand the sources of the information that they're being presented with, and that really, it turns out that that's just not the case. Another highlight, I guess, I'll kind of sum up maybe with one other illustration of the new circumstances we saw last year, and maybe it kind of contains, I think, a few hints of where things could go going forward. When Romney was first starting out, there was a donation to the super PAC supporting him. There was a Restore Our Future, you'll probably recall. They got a donation from a business entity called WSPAN LLC. And as reporters always do, as soon as the reports actually come out, whatever they do disclose, they'll just scrub it as much as they can. So reporters started going through Restore Our Futures FEC report to look for information that they could get about the donors. And they found this WSPAN LLC that they could find no other indication of whatsoever. It didn't seem to own anything. It only came into existence. They eventually found the LLC registration, I think, in Delaware or Massachusetts. But it was very shortly predating the contribution. It had come into existence like a month earlier. It gave $1,000,000 to Restore Our Future. And a week after the donation, it went away. It vanished. That's the only thing anybody ever knew this WSPAN LLC to do, was to make this contribution to Restore Our Future. Well, in one view, that's a case study of exactly how bad this can get, right? I mean, that's pretty brazen. This is not really, you know, it's not even Exxon. Or I mean, think about the entities you would know by name. Here's a completely brand new fictional business entity that gives this $1,000,000 contribution and then disappears. In practice, what actually happened is that the outcry around that donation was so loud that eventually the person behind it decided to end the mystery himself. The person who provided those funds was a guy named Ed Kennard, who used to work with Romney at Bain Capital and who knows Romney really well. They went back for decades, and his story at least was, look, I know the guy extremely well. I think he'd make a great president. I'm really happy to have the chance to help this group make some independent expenditures. I didn't talk to Romney about this at all. I didn't talk to his campaign about it at all. I never would. The reason I did it through this artificial vehicle was I don't want to be seen as a checkbook. I don't want my neighbors to view me as the guy that throws the millions of dollars around. I don't want Romney himself to think, oh God, every time I bump into Ed, he's going to be reminding me about that $1,000,000. I'm going to have this really, you know, twisted relationship if it becomes known that I'm the guy who provided this money. Which really, again, I think is actually kind of interesting. The idea of disclosure is to prevent corruption, or at least to give the public a means to police the potential for that corruption. The money might be able to still be spent, but if everybody knows where it came from, everybody can keep track. You know, will Romney ever try to give a favor back to Ed Kennard because of that $1,000,000 to the super PAC? What if the candidate himself didn't even know? Now there's no way to, who do you know how to be beholden to? How do you know how to do a favor back for the person who provided the money when there was no indication to you of where the money came from to begin with? So it illustrates a couple of things. there's a superficial level of the law that can be arranged to allow for that kind of opacity and that kind of anonymity in political spending. In practice, though, it actually seems to be very difficult to pull off. Not because the FBI will scare you or you'll get threatened with, you know, an indictment that would actually happen, but because the press outcry and the controversial aspects of what it is that took place start to overcome the upside that you thought you had by trying to do this confidentially. So I think I'll leave it there. I don't. Mike, you wanted to kind of add
a few
more points.
And I know some of you have to leave for class at 1, so obviously, as you are, you should feel free to get up and go. And forgive me for 1 minute. I don't know about all of you, but up here, it's like an icebox. So I'm putting my coat back on, even though I want it to stay as casual as possible. So Joe highlighted a couple of issues that are occupying the time and attention of practitioners, right? So one of them is this question of coordination. So as I suggested at the outset, you can engage in unlimited independent expenditures. That's not regulated. It can't be. As long as you're not coordinating those expenditures with the campaign. If you're coordinating with the campaign, then you're in trouble, right? If you're an individual, you can do that a little bit. If you're a super PAC, you can't do it at all, right? So there must be a lot of attention, I assume, among practicing lawyers to this question, what exactly counts as coordination? Is it, if I wink at you, are we coordinating? or is that not quite enough? Now, a lot of people sort of academically push on this idea, right? So to give you an example, and this is not my area of expertise, but think about collusion. So it is the case if there are two gas stations across the street from one another, and the owner, and they have their prices posted, and the owner of one of those gas stations walks across the street to the other one and says, hey, let's both raise our prices by a quarter. They're violating the law. That's collusion. But if instead one of those gas station owners goes out and raises his price, doesn't say a word, and the other gas station owner says, I'm going to raise my price too. I see what he's done, and he raises his price, there's no collusion. Perfectly legal. Same outcome, no collusion. And I imagine there's something analogous to this happening with coordination. Some things count as coordination. Some things technically, legally don't. But in practice, the distinction between them, in terms of the effects, non-existent, right? So then the other issue he's pushing onto is disclosure. Right? So the theory, as Joe said, the theory in Citizens United, and we may see this theory articulated again in McCutcheon, which is coming up not that far away, is this. As long as all this money that's flowing around is disclosed, that is to say, as long as people can access records and see who's doing the spending and when and where and why, that allows you to monitor relationships, including corrupt relationships. So it's okay to spend lots of money as long as we can see it, right? The whole sunlight is the best disinfectant idea. So this is where I'm going to inject my little theory piece for what it's worth. I'm not so sure about this line of reasoning. And I'll tell you at the outset two things. Number one, these are my ideas. So if you find them persuasive, you can give me credit. and if you think they're bunk, well, you know who to blame. I'm not repeating somebody else here. And the other thing I'll mention on this score, I'll just summarize the idea for you at the outset. Number one, I have a reason to believe, and again, we'll see if you find it persuasive, that super PACs are in fact more corruptive than we commonly suppose. So if you already think they're corrupt, this is really bad news. And if you're not so sure, well, maybe this will cause you to think again. And then the second piece of what I want to say leads to this conclusion, which is that I'm not sure disclosure helps. And in fact, it seems to me disclosure might make things worse, at least in the right circumstance. So let me take this first idea. And to explain it, I want to make reference to an important concept in corruption, which is credibility. So suppose that, credibility is a necessary thing for corrupt deals to happen. So suppose that I'm a wealthy individual, and Joe's a candidate running for office, and I want to engage in a corrupt deal with him. I want to spend a bunch of money today to get him elected, and I want him in exchange, when he gets in office, to vote my way on some bills that really matter to me. This is an illegal relationship, or an illegal proposal, right? Well, it turns out we can't sign an enforceable contract about this. We can't sign a deal under which I agree to spend and he agrees to vote, and if one of us violates, you pay damages enforceable in court. You can't do that. So in order for this to happen, we need to have an informal agreement, and that means we need credibility. So here's my position. I'm thinking, well, I'm inclined to spend this money to help him get elected if tomorrow he's credible and he's going to vote my way. On the other hand, if he's not credible, I could spend all this money today and then he's going to get in office and who knows what he's going to do, then of course I'm less inclined to spend this money, right? So I need to assess his credibility. Now it can go the other way too. Okay, so now suppose that I'm the politician and I'm not running for office, I'm already in office. I just got elected, I'm a senator, I have 6 years to go before I have to worry about this again. And he comes to me, he's now the wealthy individual of the super PAC, and he says, I would really like you to vote my way on this bill tomorrow. And in exchange, 6 years hence, I'll spend a lot of money to help you get reelected. Well, see, now I have to make the credibility determination. Is he going to be there to help me in 6 years? If the answer is yes, I'm more inclined to vote his way. If the answer is no, he's going to be in Mexico by then I'm not inclined to vote his way. So I have to make a credibility determination. Okay, now here's where super PACs come into play. So it used to be, before super PACs, the wealthy individual who says he's going to help me in 6 years, he couldn't credibly commit to do that today. I mean, he could make a $2,000 contribution to my campaign or something, but that's not enough to buy my vote. He could tell me, oh, I promise I'm going to open up my wallet in 6 years. Well, promises, talk's cheap, right? Well, now we have super PACs. We have a vehicle that is operating today, 6 years before I'm going to run for reelection, and he can today put $1 million in that super PAC. And I know that I can take some degree of confidence that in 6 years, that money's there, right? So it's the availability of a super PAC and the ability to give it unlimited sums of money, even if you're not sure it's going to help the candidate 100%, maybe not be as helpful as money contributed directly to the candidate, it still helps to some degree, right? Allows you to overcome one of these credibility problems that could ordinarily prevent corruption from happening. So this is an idea that I don't think people have talked about. I'm an academic wallowing in obscurity. They may never talk about it, but it strikes me as an important idea. And now I want to turn to the disclosure question. So remember the idea, and it relates to credibility again. So remember the argument here. The idea is, well, as long as there is disclosure of who's spending money where and when, everyone can observe it, that ought to dampen corruption. Okay, that much seems right to me. If it's easier to observe the corrupt deals, that is raising the cost of corruption because it's raising the likelihood that you'll get caught. And of course, the penalties are steep. This is, right, these are felonies. You can go to prison for this sort of thing. So on the one hand, the conventional wisdom seems right. Disclosure ought to combat corruption because it makes it easier to monitor corrupt deals. But there's, I think, another side of the story too. Disclosure can also facilitate corruption by aiding in credibility determinations. So let's return to my scenario, right? I am the wealthy individual or super PAC, and I'm thinking of spending a lot of money to get this guy elected. Well, is he going to follow through on his end of the deal and deliver the votes tomorrow? I don't know. I have to figure out if he's credible. If we have a big public disclosure record, I can consult that. And assuming he's an incumbent, I can see everyone who has given him money before and what he has done in return. And if I see him consistently voting for the people who've given him money before, who've supported his campaign, looks credible to me, that gives me a reason to engage in this money, in this spending, in this corrupt activity that, but for disclosure, I might not have done because I'm not sure this guy's credible. And it goes the other way too. So now I'm the politician and he is promising to help me out a little later on if I'll vote in his favor today. Again, by he, I mean an individual or super PACs, right? Or Colbert super PAC, which isn't in fact a super PAC. All these groups that spend the money. Okay, well, I want to know if that guy's credible. Is he gonna be here to support my campaign when I run for re-election? Well, with disclosure, I can look at the record and see who he's helped before. Does he routinely spend lots of money to assist politicians who vote the way he likes? If the answer is yes, it looks pretty credible to me. And I will engage in a corrupt deal that I otherwise maybe would have been hesitant about. So I think the disclosure argument is quite complicated. We have this conventional wisdom, and it seems right to me. On the one hand, disclosure ought to combat corruption. It raises the price of corruption because it raises the likelihood you're going to get caught. But on the other hand, disclosure facilitates corruption, or at least it can. It makes it easier in the right circumstance to make the kinds of credibility determinations that are necessary for corruption to happen. So we have these countervailing effects. Now, it could be that the monitoring effect outweighs the effect I've identified, which means that on balance, disclosure does combat corruption, just maybe not by as much as people thought. But it also seems possible to me it cuts the other way. it could be, in the right set of circumstances, that the effect I'm thinking about dominates the monitoring effect. And then we get this paradox. The more disclosure you require, the more corruption you get, not the less. I know, I told you it'd be a little depressing. I say this as an advocate of disclosure, too. I find myself torn in a way that I did not used to be.